Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, thanks for joining us. Well, earlier this week, rumours circulated on church-related websites around Australia that Australia's own Cardinal George Pell was about to be appointed to one of the central hot seats of the church as head of the College of Bishops, the body responsible for the appointment of Catholic bishops around the world. Whether that's true or not, another incident demonstrated just how hot that seat is likely to become. Another Catholic bishop today resigned over the clergy abuse crisis. The Bishop of Augsburg in Germany, Walter Mixer, resigned following allegations of hitting children and accusations that he has denied of sexual abuse. The irony of Augsburg should not be lost. It's the city forever identified with a priest called Martin Luther and the Augsburg Confession, marking the beginning of the Lutheran Church and the Protestant Reformation, a Reformation that, in rejecting the authority of the Pope, also came to claim the notion of the priesthood of all believers. In the current crisis facing the Church, some are suggesting that the problem is not just the personalities or proclivities of individual clergy, that it's an issue embedded in the Reformation's rejection of the hierarchical nature of the priesthood. It was an issue that had both institutional and theological dimensions. Clericalism became a pejorative term associated with all that was wrong with institutional church thinking and behaviour. It's a term that retains its pejorative connotations even to today. The question that perhaps needs to be asked once again in the current circumstances is, did the Reformation get it right? Is part of the problem the institutional church faces now one of a clergy who have given their lives to serve a church that are utterly dependent on that church for their spiritual, emotional, intellectual, and in a very real sense, physical sustenance? Is it too much to expect of an organisation to retain its integrity when it has such power? In this circumstance, how can the hierarchies be held to account? Perhaps only by the short shock of the sort that is now being felt, people voting with their feet. It may be only anecdotal, but those churches with a low or informal view of priesthood have proved somewhat more flexible and responsive to present-day demands of congregations. That is where churches in the West are in decline. Those with a less priestly view of ordination and clergy seem to be faring somewhat better in terms of adherence. Well, this evening, we'll be turning our attention to the priesthood in its various forms. We'll shortly be joined by scholars and clergy from Catholic, Baptist, Anglican, and Pentecostal traditions to talk about what it means to be clergy and the impact of changing times. And we're pleased to welcome into the studio Reverend Dr. Frank Rees, the principal of Whitley Baptist College in Melbourne, Dr. Marianne Confoy, a Catholic theologian from Melbourne. Also in our Sydney studio, John Giuliano, the principal of Alpha Crucis College, and Pastor Anne Giuliano, John's wife, of Chaplaincy Australia, and online from his diocese in Sale in Gippsland, the Bishop of Gippsland, the Reverend John McIntyre. Welcome to you all. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening.
Nice to be here.
Frank Rees, perhaps I could come to you. This the word priesthood gets sliced and diced in many ways according to so many traditions these days. The broad term, I guess, that embraces them all is clergy person, that person who is in some way working full-time for the church. Can you give us a broad definition of what we're talking about here?
Well, John, in a sense, I'm not the person for you to ask in the sense that priesthood is not the way that Baptists, for instance, would describe the leaders of local congregations. But to speak about priesthood more generally, I think through the history of the church, people have seen a person within each local congregation or each local area as the person who provided pastoral care, teaching from the scriptures, and who facilitated the worship of the community so that together they could be a people of God. And the priestly function in that sense throughout the history of the church has focused on those activities amongst the people.
Marianne Confort, if I could come to you next, you're somebody who's written a fair bit about this. Priesthood itself goes back into the Jewish tradition, doesn't not? A group that was set aside to actually live exclusively for the sake of temple worship, and that Christianity at some point picked that up.
Yes, and that was the sacerdotal model, the cultic model of the priest apart from the people. But can I leap back into what you said before about the elect club? In fact, John, it's about a vocation. It's about a call. Mm. One doesn't choose of oneself, or if one does choose of oneself to become a priest, then within the Roman Catholic tradition, that would be questioned, because there has to be a very real sense of a call from God for a life that is dedicated to the service of others and service in a communal context.
So this really, the general definition would be people who feel called of God, and that call is recognised by the church, or the particular church that they're a participant of, a member of, and recognised by the church, and that's honoured by some form of ordination, it's called, some form of ceremonial setting apart.
That's right. And you also mentioned the word clericalism, and so often when I hear that, my reaction to it is in terms of the whole sense of clericalism is not always that which priests themselves generate amongst themselves. Clericalism can come from people who want to see themselves to see their leaders as an elite group. And clericalism quite often, again, can move the authentic priest who is called to exercise a threefold office. And this is one of the strengths of that great meeting of the Catholic Church in the 1960s, Vatican II, where the bishops from all over the world emphasised the threefold office of priesthood, that whole sense of the priest, the prophet, the pastoral leadership, that then moved the priest back into the sense of responsibility for a relationship with the community, a leadership relationship, a relationship that's calling people to a sense of their own vocation.
I'd like to come to explore a number of those issues shortly, particularly the threefold mention you made of priest, prophet and pastor. For the moment, let's concentrate on this notion of priesthood and where that arose from. It comes out of the Jewish tradition where you have a group, almost a tribe, set apart to do the temple functions, to be those who were pure enough or lived the right sort of formulaic lives to perform the religious rituals that gave people a way of relating to their God. There's that ancient tradition where the priest was in some way the intermediary, Marianne. Would that be right?
Yes, that's the roots. That's the roots from the earlier tradition that was passed on. And then it was when the Christian communities began to grow, then there was a reworking of that understanding of priesthood. And it wasn't until between the first and third centuries that really there was a movement back into that whole sacerdotal model again.
So the church, the early Christian church, went for a couple of hundred years before it began to adopt what could be conventionally called that high view of priesthood once again.
I think so.
If I could come in there, John.
Yes,
I actually think it's very important to recognise that in the New Testament there is one word that is apparently systematically avoided in referring to the leaders of local congregations, and that's the word priest. It was, as you said, it was an established form of leadership and ministry within the Jewish tradition, but in the very early Christian centuries, those who led the congregations were not called priests. This came about, as Marianne has just said, some centuries later.
So here we have the Christians at some point in their tradition, maybe a couple of hundred years after the time of Christ, beginning to develop a discrete function that's very priestly, that is, priest is the intermediary type function, that harks back to the older Jewish tradition. It's not part of what conventionally called the apostolic years.
And that's because what we find in the New Testament, and most especially in 1 Peter chapter 2, is the development of the notion of a priestly people rather than priests. And this itself harks back into Exodus 19, where there is a call to the nation to be priestly. And those ideas of representing God, participating in God's mission, the offering of sacrifices, the mediation of God's presence and gift of salvation to the world is not the task of specific individuals alone, but in fact a calling to the entire people.
Now, this
can I just jump in there? Because, again, the antithesis of clericalism is what Frank's just been talking about there in the understanding of priesthood there, and that Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 to 11, what is the essence of the priestly identity of the people? It is that the self-emptying of Christ. And at the ordination of priests, one of the things in the in the earlier days, there was that know the mystery of the cross, the mystery of Christ, and that whole sense of the way in which you live your priesthood is in the context of this self-emptying model of Christ.
So we have a person set apart, living a Christ-like life, but in some ways given by the community. On them is bestowed a way of dealing with entry into the presence of God, which is exclusively reserved for that person. That whole notion grows up very strongly over about 1,000 years or so, and it's not until you get to the great breach in church history in the Reformation in the 16th century that that notion of the priesthood in Christianity is all of a sudden challenged once again. John McIntyre, it's probably appropriate to bring you into the discussion here, Bishop John McIntyre. When Martin Luther broke with the established church in the 16th century, it wasn't only a protest against what he saw as error. Out of that great movement sprang something else, and that was an understanding that the priesthood needed to be liberated in some sense from the institution. You get the notion of the priesthood of all believers. Now, as an Anglican, you still hang on to priestly orders, but you also have this notion of the priesthood of all believers still attached in various ways to the Anglican tradition as well.
Yeah, that's true. I think the reality is, and the word that hasn't been introduced into the conversation yet from the New Testament, is that the elders of the early Christian communities were called, in the Greek, presbyters. And in the Anglican tradition, the word priest, as we use it, is more a derivative of the word presbyter than it is picking up the Old Testament or Jewish idea of priesthood. And so, obviously, within the Anglican tradition, we say that was the role of the priest was consummated in Jesus Christ, and then the church takes up the priesthood of all believers in the sense that we, as a community, carry on the work of Christ in the life of the world. And within that community, there is an eldership, the presbyter, and within the Anglican tradition, the word priest ties back more into the notion of the presbyter than it does into the sacerdotal priesthood.
I'd like to bring John Giuliano into the discussion here, because John, you're a member of perhaps one of the more recent traditions, and your tradition has a very, not quite informal, but a very flexible notion of the priesthood. The priesthood itself has almost vanished in your understanding of the person set apart to serve the community. Just explain to us how the Pentecostals church, generally, the Assemblies of God in Australia, view full-time ministry and its theological roots, if you like.
We don't use the word priest whatsoever. So none of our ministers are called priests. They're called pastors. And we see that as a New Testament term. We believe in the priesthood of all believers. And not only the priesthood of all believers, but we also tend to believe in the prophethood of all believers. And this goes back to the day of Pentecost.
And the pastorhood of all believers.
Well, all believers are called to shepherd and look after each other. And so we certainly believe in sharing the load with others. And we call this body ministry. And I think this was very popular during the 60s and 70s, during the charismatic outpouring, where body ministry became the catchword that was used in a lot of churches, because we started to see that if the responsibility was vested only on one person, there was very limited what they could do. But if it was shared with all the believers, well, it was amazing what could be accomplished.
And this has an institutional dimension as well as a personal theological or sacramental dimension, in that you can move in and out of a pastoral role. It's not a vocation for life, even though you are a Christian and you've given your life to Jesus. That doesn't mean that you are set apart for one role. You can move in and out of roles.
Yeah, we can certainly do that.
You're not a priest forever. You could become something else of equally good standing in the church if you wish. That is, you're not a pastor forever if you don't wish to be.
Well, under the strict terminology, but you're either a carer of people or you're not. And if you're a carer of people, you'll always be a pastor. So
you're using it with a small p all the time.
Exactly. And then if you're the leader of a church, the official leader of the church, you go from little p to capital P.
So it's a functional change, though.
Exactly.
It's not a sacramental change.
Well, what's interesting in the Pentecostal churches is that anyone in the church that's a believer can be in charge of the sacraments, can lead around the communion table. So in our church at North Shore Christian Center, we have a variety of believers lead us around the communion table. We have people that also do baptism, not just the senior minister. Matter of fact, within our church, the only thing that a layperson can't do is officiate at a marriage ceremony.
And that's because of the law.
That's because of the law, right. Exactly. But they can officiate at a funeral service. They can officiate a communion. They can do a baptismal. They can pray for someone to be saved. In other words, they can minister the forgiveness of sins through the price that Jesus paid.
Anne, let me bring you in here, Anne Giuliano, because you are a chaplain, and you also have a role. You can take a pastoral role in the church, and women have equal status as pastors in the Pentecostal tradition, as they do in a number of traditions these days. But so you can fulfill any role that people happen to ask you to fulfill.
Absolutely. I'm an ordained minister with the Assemblies of God as well, and I think 25% of ministers in the Assemblies of God are women at the moment, which is wonderful.
Let me ask then about another key word here, and it's the word, Anne, you've just mentioned, and that's ordained. What does ordination mean? And this relates, Marianne Confoy, particularly to the older tradition, that is, and this is where we're going to use one of these awful technical words, that particularly in the Catholic tradition, there is an idea that at the consecration of the priest, something happens, that the person is changed irrevocably. People use the word ontologically changed. Can you just unpack that for us?
Would that I could, John, because there is so much discussion about this at the present time, and there are so many books that have been written about it. But again, to come back to the essence of what we're talking about here, there is that sense of movement that has been that is taking place and has taken place since the Vatican II of the mid-60s. That whole movement of the emphasis on power and office and all of that elevation aspect of a priesthood removed from the people, which is part of that sacerdotal past, and the movement now to a sense of a relational model of priesthood, a relational understanding of priesthood and the understanding of the responsibilities within the community and of the community for the priest. And so there's a much more communal emphasis in a lot of the writing that is taking place about the Catholic priesthood at the present time. And there's, at the same time, there are disagreements. And so in the power of the disagreements, and people are coming to a purifying of their understanding, and one that's always being informed, I would argue, by the power of the Holy Spirit.
John McIntyre, let me ask you to comment. As a bishop, somebody in the church, you've thought a lot about this. And I'll go to the clergy abuse crisis as an example, but I don't want to concentrate on that. There are too many other things that hang off that. But one of the things that people have said, that the clergy abuse crisis is not simply a matter of people who have fallen for whatever reason. There is something built into the way that priestliness is set apart, and what that does institutionally to people, that is, it binds them to an institution rather than to the people that they serve, that binding is for life, that almost predisposes people who are of a certain sort to fall into error.
Yeah, but I think that may be a misunderstanding of the priesthood from the very beginning. I think the original intent was that a priest remains part of the people of God. You know, we talk about the laity and we talk about ordained people and we divide between them. But essentially, it is that relational model that I think is the original model that we need to be rediscovering, and there is a sense in which it is being rediscovered. The commitment is not to the institution, or it should not be to the institution. I think that's where we've fallen into error. The commitment is made to God in the first place, among the people, and so it's a communal, relational idea of taking a particular responsibility and role within the life of the people of God that undergirds ordination and what ordination is about. It's, in the first place, we say, or my understanding is, that when I'm looking to ordain somebody, I'm asking the question, is this person ordained of God? And do we, as the church, therefore, have to discern that, and then we ordain when we believe that that person is ordained of God or called by God to have that role within the life of the church?
But you lock that up as a lifetime commitment.
We do, but the lifetime commitment is to God and to service of the people and alongside the people. With the people, I mean, essentially, the way I try to put it as often as possible is that the whole of the church is to be the servant of Jesus Christ by being servant to the community of which they are a part, and that the priest, within the context of that model of ministry, has a central role that is placed within the community to be the servant of Jesus Christ by being servant to the people.
Frank Rees, wasn't Martin Luther, and certainly many of his more radical, those who came after him, who were a tad more radical, making not just a theological point about the priesthood, but a political point as well? They are actually quite deliberately making a point about the institution of a priestly hierarchy which led people, because of the nature of the commitment involved, to give service to the institution before service to the people. That is, it inevitably led them in that direction.
Absolutely. It has political consequences, but at the very heart of it is a theological understanding of what is the church. The church doesn't exist because it has priests. The church exists because God calls women and men to be believers in Jesus Christ, and they are baptized into the life of the community of faith. And that's the heart of the church, the faith of the people, out of which there may arise, as John has suggested, the kind of leadership which may or may not be called priesthood, presbyter, pastor, the various words that we've been using tonight. But the really important thing about, at the heart of all that, is that it is the life and ministry of Christ through the Spirit amongst the whole people, which is the church. Now, that has, as you've just said, power political, but I would also want to say empowering significance for the whole church. It frees those who are called to be presbyters, pastors, priests. It frees them to a particular role. It doesn't expect them to be the whole church. It doesn't expect them to be everything in the church. The priesthood of the whole church is the ministry of the Spirit through all the people. And what Luther was pushing towards was, and he used the notion of called for every Christian, that the priesthood of the church would be expressed in whatever people did in their living, in their working, in their neighbourhood, in their raising of children, and so forth.
I appreciate what the discussion we're having. It's been about ideals, in a sense. What I'm suggesting is there is a very practical dimension to Luther's reservations about the full ordination style, that the priestly caste style that had been there in the church for many years, and that there were problems with that which led people to identify with authority in a certain way. Marianne Confoy, let me raise the issue with you. You mentioned, for example, Vatican II and the great winds of change that swept through the church in Vatican II. And one of the things that was interesting about Vatican II was the notion of the people of God. And most important symbolically in that notion of the people of God was when the priest in the Mass turned away from the high altar and faced the people. And it was almost as though the church was recognising that the priest is the servant of the people in that act, whereas before the danger had been, and almost it wasn't there in theological terms, but it was there in practical terms, and in a way, the priest turning away from the people and facing the high altar was that, well, look, you know, the people there behind me are no my concern. My concern is God and the church. Now, I'm giving a pretty arbitrary political reading, but certainly that's been a popular discussion point over the years. And what you're pointing to is a profound change of sensibility, a recognition that there was a need, that there were problems with the highly institutional functional view.
Well, the big thing for us in Vatican II was that real emphasis on the universal call to holiness that Frank's been talking about and others have been addressing too, that sense of the common priesthood of the baptized. Now, that was emphasized in an entirely new way at Vatican II. It wasn't in any way meant to downplay the significance of the ordained priesthood, but you've encapsulated it in your picture of the priest turning towards the people, the changing structure of the church, the people around, the more circular understanding, circular structuring of the congregation in the church. So the relational aspect of it, of priesthood, the mutuality, is something that is a developing of the post-Vatican period.
And I guess there's something being learnt here off those churches that moved into a more flexible understanding of the priesthood. John Giuliano.
Yeah. One of the things that I think the Pentecostals are different towards is a word that's not been used yet, and it's the word mediation, and the priest being seen as the mediator between the people and God. We believe that when Jesus died on the cross, rose from the dead, that middle wall, that partition, was removed, and he became the mediator. So the minister is no longer the mediator between God and man. Jesus Christ is the mediator. He's the bridge between God and man. And the minister is simply the leader of the congregation of priests who found their own mediation through Jesus Christ.
Yep. Yes, Frank, you wanted to comment on that?
I would say that that's a view that our tradition would affirm strongly as well. Yes. I'm agreeing with John there.
John McIntyre, you'd take a sort of, the Anglican Church would take an end both view on that, would it not?
Well, Yeah, we tend to be a bit both and on a lot of things. But a question that I was going to raise, which I think lies behind a lot of the discussion, is recent dialogue about the nature of God, and that within the Western Church in particular, we, in a sense, have rediscovered a far more relational view of who God is. Mm-hmm. When we talk of God as Trinity, we have a notion far more strongly now that God, in God's very self, is community, and that the relationship between the three persons of the Trinity actually leads us in the life of the Church to try and reflect that notion of community that is a unity in diversity in which there are particular roles, I guess, that enable that community to be formed. And so that's so behind a lot of the discussion at the moment about the a more relational view of being priest, a more relational understanding of what it means even to be Christian, is this more relational understanding of who God is.
That gives you the capacity to think more flexibly about function, does it not?
Absolutely. But if you see the relationship between the three persons of the Trinity as a kind of mutuality, which I think is the best way to understand it, then it builds the concept of mutuality between priest and people within the life of the Church, rather than a hierarchical idea. And if Western theology went wrong with its Trinitarian theology, it kind of had God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit in a kind of a hierarchy. You know, one was telling the other what to do, and the other one was trying to work out what they both wanted to do or something. Whereas a really Trinitarian view of God sees there's an interplay of mutuality, and some call it mutual submission to each other, whereby the will of God is known out of that engagement and dialogue between the three persons of the Trinity. That then gives you a far more flexible notion of how the Church works and how particular roles and functions within the Church engage with each other. So you can have people who will be ordained within the life of the Church who remain part of the whole and are in relationship with the whole with particular roles and functions that are performed and exercised in that mutuality.
Anne Giuliano, let me bring you in here. As a wife, a mother, a pastor, a chaplain, you can't do all of those roles at the same time. You have the flexibility to move in and out of those roles.
I do. It's been a challenge right throughout my life to try and get the balance right between those roles. And it was seasonal. And so when my children were young, I only supported John as much as I could. The priority was making sure the kids were okay. As they've got older, I've moved more into the ministerial roles. And then came the chaplaincy roles as well. But it is a balance for a woman, definitely.
Yeah, but there was no sense in which if you left one role, you were somehow forsaking a sacred duty to take up another sacred duty. There's a sense in which all of them are equally, equally part of your calling.
Absolutely, and I think that God understands the seasons of a woman's life as well and a man's life, and allows us to go in and out as is called for.
John Giuliano, this has practical dimensions too, does it not? In that within the Pentecostal tradition, because people can flexibly move out in and out of roles, that you don't develop an institutional hierarchy that basically owns the Church.
No, we don't. Our tradition, the Assemblies of God in Australia, which is now called the Australian Christian Churches.
Yeah, we'll allow you that, Chuck.
Okay. I don't want to be controversial here tonight.
Little exclusive okay. Claim there, folks.
Well, we're really a fellowship of autonomous churches, and our hierarchy would be more to do with the ordination of ministers rather than the supervision of specific churches. So we view the ordination of ministers as the recognition of a call. I think Mary Ann early on mentioned the word call, and what that means can be very nebulous, but we believe that there are particular individuals that sense a call of God to specific ministry of leadership within the church. And within our tradition, being a pastor is the more specific of all the roles, and that's heading up a church and heading up the leadership of a church. And so when we see that upon someone, the leadership role and the leadership gift, we tend to ordain them into the ministry.
But that's about as high as the hierarchical structure goes. I mean, you can go into other structures in the Assemblies of God, but they're temporary. You go into it for, you might be doing another job, and you're elected president of whatever body for a period of time.
Right.
There's no sort of permanent hierarchy, like you don't become a bishop or you don't become, it's not a...
And that election comes from the other pastors.
Right.
So there's not one senior bishop that chooses the junior bishops or, you know, the hierarchy of the church. It's all done from the fellowship of pastors.
What do you say, would you claim the strength of that is?
The strength is that whatever level of leadership, they're only in for a couple of years term, and then if there's someone that the fellowship feels can do a better job, they get put in, or if the leader himself or herself feels that I've done all that I can do, I can step aside. So there's this constant flow of leadership and talent and people coming into the various gifts as others recognize there's someone with an extraordinary sense of leadership.
So there's a renewal of ideas at every level. It's not just at the bottom. It can be at the top as well. Now, that's a singular advantage, I guess you'd argue, in the marketplace of ideas amongst the churches that you have to contribute these
days.
There's
a weakness there too.
Well, that's what I'd like to come to, John McIntyre. Please feel free.
Well, I guess I would see that the great weakness of the more congregational model is that it sometimes has an incredible capacity to limit the prophetic role of leadership in the church. And in churches...
You mean prophetic in a political sense, a social sense?
I think the weakness of congregational-style churches is that the congregation can get rid of the voice that they don't like too easily. And I think the great strength of a church that has both an up and a down kind of model of leadership means that a person can stay in a context where the people don't like what that person is saying because of the particular role that has been affirmed by the whole church, not just that particular congregation of the church.
Yes.
And that is the prophetic role. Sometimes the people don't like to hear what it is that God might be saying through somebody, and in a congregational model, they can vote them out.
Yeah, can I I agree with what you're saying, John. What's interesting about our particular tradition is that we have that on a denominational basis, whereas within the congregational setting, we veered away from that. So there's not too many congregations in the Assemblies of God Australia that are left that vote their pastor in every year. We do that for our leadership in the movement. But that's done through the fellowship of pastors, which is at a different level. But within churches, my church never votes on whether they're going to keep Ananias pastors for another year or
so. They wouldn't dare.
We're connected, see. We've got friends.
this is a very critical issue, though, because it does go to the way in which sacred roles can be performed, and the way in which organisation and politics really does have an important clarifying dimension or an enabling dimension in the faith. You pointed out, John, John Iliano, the strength of that congregational character of the Pentecostal church, and Frank, you'd apply this also to the Baptist tradition. The strongly rooted congregational thing enables flexibility, responsivity, and those other things. But as John McIntyre is pointing out, and Marianne, I'd like to come to you on this, there is something important about the notion of the church universal, that it's not just an idea, that it has concrete manifestations, and those concrete manifestations can be exercised.
I guess one of my concerns as I listened to both John and Anne was the fact that the church can be so small in those contexts in many ways. That was how I was hearing it. And that whole sense of the church universal, yes, the church global, that sense of the accountability which reaches out, and the sense of we're a church with a past, and our present carries that past, but also it carries a future. So that realization that the ministerial priesthood is something that is it's multi-dimensional in its sacramental, its liturgical, its preaching, its teaching, its pastoral leadership, but always with a larger vision, historically and globally.
Our guests in the studio are Frank Rees, the principal of Whitley Baptist College in Melbourne, Dr. Marianne Confoy, also in our Melbourne studio in the Catholic tradition, John Iliano, who is principal of Alpha Crucis College in Sydney, together with his wife Anne, who is also a pastor in the church, and Bishop John McIntyre, the Anglican Bishop of Gippsland. Let me talk about these two different models, and Frank, you're perhaps the best one to talk about this or reflect on this, that there are two quite different models of church here, both of which are extremely powerful. And I guess the Uniting Church, maybe, in fact, not the Baptist, but the Uniting, the best example of where these exist in tension, and that the Uniting Church brought together two models of ministry which seem to try and embrace both. That is the local congregational model coming out of the Congregational Church, and out of its Methodist Wesleyan tradition, a broader notion of the church universal. There was still a notion of episcopal universality in some aspects of the Wesleyan tradition. And these are both important, it seems, that you can't lose one or the other.
Well, I would think that, well, you're right about that, and I think every church wrestles with finding the balance between those two things, and that's one of the issues for the different models. But can I just say, in affirming what John McIntyre said about recent recognitions of the nature of God as Trinity, that I think this whole conversation also needs to be disciplined by the recognition that God is not only interested in the church and what kind of leadership or ministry structures we have in the church, what kind of governance we have in the church. God is actually interested in the world. And the church exists for the world. The church exists for God's mission to the world. And if our understandings of priesthood are only focused on the church, then that is, doesn't matter which model we have, that is where we are going to get into trouble.
That's an excellent segue into the last three questions that I had, Frank Rees. You were obviously reading my notes here.
He's inspired by the Spirit.
Because it seems to me that if you take either the model, either the congregational model or the hierarchical model, the risks are that you can be sucked into basically seeing your roles as clergy as serving the congregation. Yes. Or serving the institution, mm-hmm. And that Frank, in your view, that way lies death.
Yes, the church itself, if it's only interested in its own structures, whether it's a local congregation or a much larger gathering of congregations or a diocese or even the church universal, if it is only focused in that, then it is already lost the plot. It has missed the point altogether.
Yeah, I'd agree entirely with that. I've got no argument with that. I think that the church exists for the sake of the world, and once it loses that perspective, then it can hardly call itself Christian. It can hardly.
Can I focus on that definition for just a moment? Yeah, and Marianne, but I'll just want to ask one thing. When you say church exists for the sake of the world, do you mean just to save souls and put them in the heavenly lifeboat, or to actually be agents of transformation in the world?
Well, the second, of course, because I think the reality is that, I think it was a former Archbishop of Canterbury who said that it's the only voluntary or association in the world that exists for the benefit of non-members only. And I think that's a rather lovely way of putting it, that we are not just out there to try and get people to join us. We are out there in the life of the world seeking to enable the things of God to be born in the life of that world, to see justice done, to see compassion reign in the lives of people, to see peace come, to make reconciliation not for our own sakes, but for the sake of the world in which we serve.
Marianne Confoy, just briefly.
And yes, I want to say, in affirmation of what's been said, but also the now and the not yet, the reign of God, mm-hmm. present and to come. So that's our responsibility, and that's the larger vision that we must always have.
And, Giuliano, you were going to say something there. You were nodding your head either in affirmation or...
I was just thinking of Ephesians chapter 4 when it talks about the leaders such as God giving the gifts, the apostles, the prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers. And why? Because their responsibility is to build up the body of Christ so that they can do the work.
And I guess it's what we mean by the body of Christ there, doesn't it? How do we build up the body of Christ? John Giuliano.
Yeah, well, we see it as a dual role. We see our role as ministers to make disciples of those that are Christians and then reach out into the pre-Christians, evangelizing them, winning those people that have not yet received Jesus as their Lord and Savior, doing good, doing great acts of charity, but that leading to a point where we're embracing the world with love and nurture. So we believe that Jesus told us to do two very specific things. Go into all the world, preach the gospel to every creature, and make disciples. And so you make disciples of those who've been evangelized. That's the work within the church.
This is the historic tension of the Great Commission. Preach the gospel and make disciples, but then you have the other, the Matthew, you know, in as much as you've done it to the least of these, the sort of bread for the hungry, water for the prisoner. This is much a part of the commission as saving souls.
Well, we do good. That's part of...
But do you do good just to get people into church, or do good to serve the world?
No, we do good to serve the world, but we don't remove from ourselves the obligation of preaching the gospel. So preaching the gospel is an articulation of the message. Doing good is a wonderful thing to do, but it's not preaching the gospel. There are two different things.
Frank Rees, are they? Yeah, Marianne, are they two different things? You've got about 30 seconds.
I just wonder, as I listen to this, as I listen to the diversity and the richness of the comments from our different traditions and understanding of priesthood, this is where I think, again, the mutuality and the richness of our conversations are transforming, not just for ourselves, but also for the communities that we belong to and the world in which we're ministering. And that's what I think our message is.
Thanks to Frank Rees, Marianne Confoy, John Giuliano, Anne Giuliano, and Bishop John McIntyre. It's been great to have you with us on Sunday night.
Thank you very much.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.